on Wednesday for the examination on Wednesday, you may bring your copies of the three books, the Bible, the Plato, and the Sophocles. But please do not bring anything else with you. And I would like to caution you, well, by that I mean, you know, no other books or notes. I would like to caution you, some of you need this advice. Please read the question. Some of you have not learned how to do that. Try to understand the question. Don't answer a question that hasn't been asked. You get no credit for it. Answer the question that's asked. If you get nothing else out of the examinations by the end of the semester, at least get that much out of it. The ability to answer a question, first of all, to read a question, to understand it. You may not be able to answer it after you've read it and after you've understood it. That's another problem. I can't talk about that at this moment. But at least you will know what the question is. And if you fail, you will fail honorably in terms of your intelligence. You'll get at least credit for your intelligence. Now, this is not the ability to read and understand a question and to direct your mind to the question is not an art with which people are born. It's not an innate idea. You have to acquire it. And if you don't acquire it now, I don't know when you will acquire it. Now, let me go back to where we left off on Friday. I try to make clear the point towards the end of the hour that Sophocles made a great contribution in the development of the moral sense by introducing the distinction between suffering as punishment and suffering which has nothing to do with guilt, but simply the fact that human beings suffer. It has nothing to do with a moral or a legal judgment. In Oedipus at Colonus that you've been reading, Oedipus says, "No, I did not sin." At another point, he says, "Killed him? Yes, there is." And the chorus asks, "What more?" Oedipus, "A just extenuation. This, I did not know him. And he wished to murder me. Before the law, before God, I am innocent." And again, at another point in the play, "And I knocked him down, not knowing that I killed him, nor whom I killed. Again, how could you find guilt in that unmeditated act?" He asks that. "No, I shall not be judged an evil man, neither in that marriage nor in that death, which you forever charge me with so bitterly." "No," he says, "I shall not be judged an evil man." Now, this was revolutionary. In some ways, it is, as I pointed out to you on Friday, comparable to the outcry of both Jeremiah and Ezekiel, and particularly Ezekiel, about the distinction between guilt and innocence from a legal and moral point of view. Now, there's one other distinction that you have to make in this context, and that is between guilt and pollution. Pollution, you have the word in the dramas. Although Oedipus was not legally and not morally guilty, since he acted in ignorance, both in the killing of his father and in the cohabitation with his mother, he is still, even though he was innocent in terms of his will, his mind, his knowledge, he was still something horrible. He was a polluted person, someone to be shunned, as if he carried an infectious plague. And indeed, Thebes was sent a plague because of Oedipus. To kill one's father, parricide, and incest of the kind of which Oedipus was charged, polluted him. Either one alone would have been sufficient. The two together made him an abomination. They were offenses against the gods, and they had to be atoned, guilty or innocent. The city that harbored Oedipus as king was sent the plague by the gods because Oedipus carried the plague with him. The Greeks believed that any grave crime, any grave outrage, even though legally not a crime or morally not a crime, called for atonement. It was the same feeling that you get from the Bible, the Hebrew scriptures, and time and again it comes out, that the very earth cries out when blood is shed, that the earth finds the situation intolerable. You have a number of examples of pollution in the Bible. In Exodus, it is stated that when an ox, who certainly isn't subject to moral or legal judgment, when an ox gores a man or a woman to death, the ox was to be stoned and its flesh was not to be eaten. As it was intolerable that this beast, this animal that had taken a human life, should continue to walk on the face of the earth. Now, the Hebrew scriptures clearly distinguish between an act done with criminal intent and an act done innocently. For that reason, in Deuteronomy, as you remember, there was a provision made for cities of refuge. If a man slayed another person innocently, he could run to a city of refuge where he would be beyond reach for vengeance, for anger, for any harm that might otherwise come to him. There wasn't a police force that could protect such a person at all times. You couldn't put out a police guard in front of his home and accompany him wherever he goes. So he could run to a city of refuge. He was entitled to his life. He had taken a life, but he had taken it innocently. So he was entitled to live. But the idea of pollution still comes out time and again. There's a very clear instance of it. When a murdered man was found in the open country, and it was unknown who the killer was, in Deuteronomy it is provided, if in the land which the Lord your God gives you to possess, anyone is found slain, lying in the open country, and it is not known who killed him, then your elders and your judges shall come forth, and they shall measure the distance to the cities which are around him that is slain. So the place is always between different cities, so you measure the distance between the place where the person was slain and the different cities. And the elders of the city which is nearest to the slain man shall take a heifer which has never been worked and which has not pulled in the yoke, and the elders of that city shall bring the heifer down to a valley with running water, which is neither plowed nor sown, and shall break the heifer's neck there in the valley. And the priests, the sons of Levi, shall come forward, for the Lord your God has chosen them to minister to him and to bless in the name of the Lord. And by their word, every dispute and every assault shall be settled. And all the elders of that city, nearest to the slain man, shall wash their hands over the heifer whose neck was broken in the valley. And they shall testify and shall say, our hands did not shed this blood, neither did our eyes see it shed. Forgive, O Lord, thy people Israel, whom thou hast redeemed, and set not the guilt of innocent blood in the midst of thy people Israel, but let the guilt of blood be forgiven them. So you shall purge the guilt of innocent blood from your midst, when you do what is right in the sight of the Lord. It's a clear instance here of how the city must feel that it is polluted until this sacrifice is made, this religious ceremony is gone through for a purging of the pollution. You have a good deal of this in the Theban plays, very similar in tone and even in action. Oh, I think you probably find instances of this throughout ancient civilization. And it's a point that needs to be stressed, because it has made a tremendous contribution, I think, into a kind of built-in system or order of moral values that we have, in which human life plays a very preeminently important role. Now, the point I'm trying to make here is that Sophocles clearly marks off the pollution from the guilt. That is, Oedipus is not morally guilty, he's not legally guilty, but nonetheless, he is polluted, and Sophocles doesn't question that. It's an important religious value. He accepts that. He ought to be polluted. Anybody who is guilty of the enormities, not guilty again in the legal or moral sense, but the fact that he did these enormities, he's not to be looked upon as just an ordinary person and allowed to go on in his usual way. Now, as we have seen in Aeschylus, there is an overriding justice, as I explained to you, a nemesis, which distributes rewards and punishments on a basis of what Aeschylus believed was strict moral accountability. The gods don't play any tricks. The gods are just, and people suffer because they are guilty. As we saw, this was the view of Job's friends. In Sophocles, there's an overriding divine wisdom and a divine righteousness, not justice, but a divine wisdom and righteousness which accounts for the role that each person plays in the universal moral order that operates in the world. An order which somehow, even though mysteriously, accounts even for the suffering of the innocent. It's not very different from the wisdom that came to Job at the end, after he heard the voice out of the whirlwind, a reconciliation. And as a matter of fact, there are some very interesting analogies that one could draw. At the end of Oedipus at Colonus, Colonus was, of course, as you know, a suburb of Athens. Athens was a city-state, but the rulership of a city-state was not limited to the confines of the city. Athens controlled the area around Athens, so that the state was larger than the city. The city-state took in more than the city. Colonus belonged, therefore, to Athens. At the end of Oedipus at Colonus, you know that Oedipus becomes a hero. He is claimed by the gods. He has a kind of a mystical experience towards the end when he seems to feel that his end has come and that he will become the guardian spirit of Athens, which is what he becomes. He didn't want to go back to Thebes. He didn't want to become the guardian spirit of Thebes, which had expelled him. And he didn't want to do that much for his sons, whom he hated because of what they did to him. They were not good sons, they were evil. And so he wanted to be buried in Athens. And Theseus the king recognizes by some sense that there was a phenomenon that was about to happen here, a divine manifestation. And he is grateful for the fact that Oedipus will be buried in the soil of Athens and becomes something in between a man and a god. He dies like a human being, but only Theseus will know his burial place, and the successors to the throne of Theseus will know his burial place. Oh, something that reminds one of what happened to Moses, that no one knew his burial place, but he died. There's no question about it that he was buried. And here, too, there was a burial. Theseus took care of that. His own daughters, Oedipus's daughters, didn't know. They weren't allowed to go near, and they didn't know where their father was being buried. But it didn't matter. What happens here is there's a kind of a reconciliation between Oedipus and the gods. He is purged of the pollution. And not only that, but more than that, he becomes a kind of a sacred person, one who's going to be close to the gods and who will be able to look after the welfare of Athens. Athens will defeat Thebes. Thebes will lose in the conflict which in the years to come will take place. Theseus didn't know that there was going to be a war between the two cities. But Oedipus, somehow or other, because he was already almost a god, knew that there would be a war. And so this is another example of the overriding wisdom that is operative in the universe, with a morality, a moral order, which is beyond human understanding, beyond human knowledge. But here and there is a penetration of the mystery. And you had the same thing, of course, at the end of Job, where there is the reconciliation, there is the reconstitution of Job, and there is the recognition that Job deserves a better fate than he had suffered. Now, there's another aspect that I want to touch upon here, and this is that the Theban tragedies of Sophocles mark an advance. This is a familiar theme to us. You've been prepared for it, but here you have a manifestation of it. An advance in the distinction between appearance and reality, between knowledge and mere opinion which is based on ignorance. A distinction that originated, as we saw, with the pre-Socratic philosophers, who applied this distinction to the realm of nature, to metaphysics. Socrates, as we saw, applied this distinction to the moral realm, and argued with his fellow Athenians that they were misled by ignorance and mere opinion, that their moral judgments weren't worth anything, that there was a realm of reality that they had to try to win for themselves. Now, Sophocles applied this distinction to religion and to the moral order. He agreed with Socrates in one respect and moved into another field in another respect. He Well, of course, Socrates did too, but it comes out more clearly in the case of Sophocles, the application of the distinction to religion as well as to the moral order. The example that I just gave you as to what happens at the end of Oedipus at Colonus is an application of this distinction where reality wins out over appearance at the final moment when there is the manifestation of the divine order. Men know little, or maybe even nothing. Men act on the basis of mere appearances, illusions, hopes that are full of illusions. But there is another realm of truth and reality which is known by the gods, and known only by the gods, which occasionally they share with human beings. Again, it's like good deal like Job's conclusion. And from this point of view, you see that Oedipus for years thought that the king of Corinth was his father, that the wife of the king was his mother. Of course, he was wrong. That wasn't the reality. He only thought so. He killed Laius, who appeared to be a total stranger. In reality, he was his father. Laius was his father. When the prophet Tiresias comes to Thebes or to try to explain the reason for the plague, and suggests that it may be due to the fact that the murder of the king, Laius, has not been punished. Oedipus takes upon himself, utters a curse upon the killer. And he says that this or that must happen to that murderer. And he undertakes passionately to find the identity of the murderer so that he might be punished, and in that way the plague on Thebes would be ended. But in reality, he takes the curse upon himself because he is the murderer of Laius. And the people in those days took a curse very seriously. You have a lot of this also in the Bible. It's the same feeling about the curse. You remember the story about Balaam, who was asked by the king who wanted to fight the Israelites for his prophet to put a curse on Israel. With the curse, he could win. Instead of that, his prophet put a blessing on Israel. That made all the difference in the world. There are lots of instances of how seriously the blessing and the curse. Of course, you have the blessings of the father, Jacob blessing his sons, and how important that was. But the curse was even more important because, God forbid, what would happen if there were a curse. The curse had to be fulfilled. Oedipus had to fulfill the curse, though he placed it on himself unknowingly. Almost all his suffering comes from self-inflicted wounds, from his own failure to discover the reality as distinguished from the appearance, brought on by his own ignorance. Almost every affliction, his own illusions, his own proneness, of course, to passionate anger and to hubris, which are tied in with his illusions and with his ignorance, standing in the way of the truth. So these are very great plays, the first two that we have in your readings. But let me move on to Antigone, which perhaps is the greatest of all. After the events that were related in Oedipus the King, Oedipus is no more the king. He blinded himself, his wife and his mother at the same time, Jocasta, had committed suicide. It is now known that he was guilty in quotation marks of parricide, killing of his father, and the terrible incest marriage of his mother, so that his sons and his daughters are also his brothers and his sisters. Such confusion, such moral confusion, unheard of, unthinkable, the enormity of what this man had done. But he lived on in Thebes with his two sons and his two daughters. And of course, he could no longer be king. And Polynices, the elder of the two sons, also abdicated, gave up his claims to the throne. And Creon, the brother of Jocasta, Oedipus's brother-in-law, became regent. After some time, for reasons unknown, Creon urged the expulsion of Oedipus. And here's where the two sons became such miscreants. They consented to the action that Creon was to take to expel the old man. Oedipus, of course, helpless, left, and Antigone went with him. Antigone, one of the loveliest characters in all literature. The younger of the two sisters, Ismene, stayed behind in Thebes to keep her father and Antigone informed on what was happening in their city in Thebes. Then Polynices and Eteocles, the two sons, each claimed a throne. And Polynices, being the elder, thought he had a better claim, but Eteocles won out in the contest. And Polynices left Thebes with the idea of raising an army that would attack Thebes. And of course, this was a great wrong, a great revolutionary, subversive action against Thebes, that he would lead an army of strangers who would come and sack Thebes. Polynices collected six chieftains and their armies, and he with them, these were the seven against Thebes, which is the subject of another play. They attacked the seven armies led by the seven chieftains, with Polynices one of them, attacked Thebes at the seven gates of Thebes. And at each of these seven gates, there was a Theban army, one of them led by Eteocles, to defend the city. The struggle was inconclusive. And so, as a last resort, it was decided that the two brothers should alone fight, and the winner would become the king. So they went into a fight, the two of them, the two brothers, one of the great tragic scenes, brothers killing each other, and they did kill each other. There's a moving passage. Eteocles looked at his brother and wept. He had no strength to utter any words. Polynices had just enough strength to say, "My brother, my enemy, but love it, always loved." One of the great sentences. "My brother, my enemy, but loved, always loved." There's an echo that one has ringing in one's ears from 2 Samuel, where there was the conflict, equally tragic, perhaps even more, between a father and a son for the throne, between David and Absalom, his oldest son. And when, well, this is the end, let me read this to you. And behold, the Cushite came, and the Cushite said, "Good tidings for my lord the king." This is to David. "For the Lord has delivered you this day from the power of all who rose up against you." The king said to the Cushite, "Is it well with the young man, Absalom?" Imagine, this is the father asking about his son Absalom, who was leading an army against him to destroy him. And the Cushite answered, "May the enemies of my lord the king and all who rise up against you for evil be like that young man." And the king was deeply moved, and he went up to the chamber over the gate and wept. And as he wept, one of the great moving outcries in literature. Well, Creon, with both brothers now dead, Creon took control, and here's where the beginning of the Antigone takes place, of the play. Creon ordered that the body of Eteocles be buried with state honors. After all, he fought for Thebes against Polynices and the outside forces. But at the same time, he ordered that the body of Polynices be left unburied for beasts and birds. Now, this was to carry vengeance beyond the limits of what was conceived to be the laws and the rights. One doesn't punish the dead. It's a sacred duty to bury the dead, no matter who they are, no matter who the dead is. Regarding the burial of the dead, all ancient peoples had a horror of leaving a corpse, no matter whose, unburied. There was the feeling that his ghost would not be at peace until the corpse is buried. The ghost moves about. It may cause harm to living human beings. Mixed in with that is a general fear of the face of death. There's the very subtle feeling that death comes to everyone. It may be done to oneself. If a corpse may be left unburied, what is there to keep one's own corpse from being buried? And this was a horrible thing to contemplate. In Deuteronomy, there's the commandment that if a man is hanged, if a criminal is hanged, his corpse was to be cut down before nightfall and buried. You don't leave a corpse, even of an arch criminal, you don't leave him unburied. I still remember the horror that I felt years ago when, I guess this was in 1944, 45, when the world became aware of the fact that Mussolini and his mistress had been caught by Italians, loyal Italians, and that they were shot. And then their bodies were brought into Rome, and they were hanged in a public square, upside down, feet up and head down. I thought at the time, and I'm sure a lot of other people thought, that this was a beastly thing to do. We didn't have any good word for Mussolini, I needn't say. That's not the point. Whoever it is, it's a corpse. You just don't treat the corpse of a human being that way. There's a wonderful story told in one of the apocryphal books, books in the of the Apocrypha. The book is Tobit. This relates, it'll give you an idea of what is involved here. If you bring to bear on these plays some knowledge from another civilization, I think it helps you bring out more clearly the values that are involved. In the book of Tobit, at the very beginning, it is related how Tobit, being now a subject in Nineveh of the king of Assyria, this was after the sacking of Israel. The Israelites, the Jews, were in exile. And he relates, in the days of Shalmaneser, I performed many acts of charity to my brethren. I would give my bread to the hungry and my clothing to the naked. And if I saw any one of my people dead and thrown out behind the wall of Nineveh, I would bury him. And if Sennacherib the king put to death any who came fleeing from Judea, I buried them secretly. For in his anger he put many to death. When the bodies were sought by the king, they were not found. Then one of the men of Nineveh went and informed the king about me, that I was burying the dead. So I hid myself. When I learned that I was being searched for to be put to death, I left my home in fear. Then all my property was confiscated, and nothing was left to me except my wife Anna and my son Tobias. And then Aikar interceded for me, and I returned to Nineveh. Would you please listen to this? When I arrived home, and my wife Anna and my son Tobias were restored to me at the Feast of Pentecost, a good dinner was prepared for me, and I sat down to eat. It was the holiday, and it was a celebration of their return to Nineveh. Upon seeing the abundance of food, I said to my son, go out and bring whatever poor man of our brethren you may find who is mindful of the Lord, and I will wait for you. But he came back and he said, Father, one of our people has been strangled and thrown into the marketplace. So before I tasted anything, I sprang up and removed the body to a place of shelter until sunset. And when I returned, I washed myself and ate my food in sorrow. Then I remember the prophecy of Amos, how he said, your feast shall be turned into mourning. And I wept. When the sun had set, I went and dug a grave and buried the body. And my neighbors laughed at me and said, he is no longer afraid that he will be put to death for doing this. He once ran away, and here he is burying the dead again. So this was this problem of burying the dead of Antigone, by Antigone, was not a whim. It was not a caprice. There are critics who have claimed that she was a headstrong, capricious person, that she shouldn't have done what she did. But I think people who write that way have no feeling for the depth of the emotions that are involved in the situation. Antigone resorted to what we have referred to before as civil disobedience. This is a clear case of civil disobedience. The story is complicated by the fact that Antigone was betrothed to Creon's son, Haman. Creon orders her execution, execution in quotation marks. He didn't think he was executing her because he ordered her to be put into a cave where the cave would be sealed and she would die there. His hand wouldn't touch her. See, there were all these refinements that people resort to avoid blood on their own hands. But of course, this was a subterfuge. Haman takes his own life when he knows that what's happening to Antigone. He goes into the cave and he kills himself. And then when his mother, Creon's wife, Eurydice, hears about what happened to her son, she takes her life. So you see how one thing leads to another, and these are natural things. These are not forced. It isn't that, you know, anybody would say that one had to invent these happenings. They sound very real. There have been different views expressed about the play. First, there is a view held by some critics that the hero really is Creon, contrary to what other people might say. Because Creon represents social stability, what we would refer to today as law and order, the social and political order. On the other hand, there are those who claim, together with Hegel, that there are, in fact, two heroes. And that the drama is such a great drama because they are equally right. That Creon is right, and that Antigone is right. As Hegel argued also in the case of Socrates, that those who prosecuted Socrates were right, because Socrates was guilty of the two charges. But of course, Socrates was also right. Hegel, in his work on tragedy, the collision between the two highest moral powers is set forth in a plastic fashion in that supreme and absolute example of tragedy, the Antigone. In this case, family love, what is holy, what belongs to the inner life and to inner feeling, and which because of this is also called the law of the gods, comes into collision with the law of the state. Creon is not a tyrant, but really a moral power. Creon is not in the wrong. He maintains that the law of the state, the authority of the government, is to be held in respect, and that punishment follows the infraction of the law. Each of these two sides realizes only one of the moral powers and has only one of these as its content. This is the element of one-sidedness here. And the meaning of eternal justice is shown in this, that both end in injustice just because they are one-sided, though at the same time, both obtain justice too. Both are recognized as having a value of their own in the untroubled course of morality. Here they both have their own validity, but a validity which is equalized. It is only the one-sidedness in their claims which justice comes forward to oppose. Then there are those who claim that both are equally wrong. That Creon was headstrong, Creon was violating the unwritten laws, the customs, the morality that should have obtained, and on the other hand, that Antigone was equally wrong. Antigone has lost her life. This is A.C. Bradley, one of the great critics who wrote mostly on Shakespeare, but of course he also wrote on this tragedy. Thus Antigone has lost her life through her absolute assertion of the family against the state. And Creon has violated the sanctity of the family and returns, sees his own home laid in ruins. But in this catastrophe, neither the right of the family nor that of the state is denied. What is denied is the absoluteness of the claim of each. Each was wrong in making an absolute claim for his or her side. However, I would say, and a lot of critics have said this, of course, I think it probably is the pervasive view that Sophocles believed that Antigone was right and that Creon was wrong. Creon's decree is spoken of as an affront to humanity. And in the Greek drama, when one acts out of the basic necessities of human life, or in response to a deep sacred instinct, he is said to be working with the gods, and the gods are said to be working with him. If a person wills action towards the good, it is said that the gods help him. You have the same feeling, of course, in the Bible, throughout the Bible. Just as on the other side, if a person chooses to think of proposing for himself an evil action, it is said in the Greek drama that the gods then take advantage of his evil imagination and of his evil desire, just as in the Bible, as I call to your attention, that phenomenon is referred to. It's in these ways that man remains free and responsible, and while at the same time, the universal laws operate and become particularized, concretized in the specific human deeds, so that you have two different levels constantly in operation. A person seems to work on the level of his own thoughts and his own will, and at the same time there's the operation of the gods on their level and on the level of what they project as their laws. In the Antigone, and the girl Antigone is shown working with the gods, and they are shown working with her. At the end of the play, there's no question about what the chorus feels, and they speak for Sophocles. Of happiness, the crown and chiefest part is wisdom, and to hold the gods in awe. This is the law that, seeing the stricken heart of pride brought down, we learn when we are old. Creon's pride was broken. He was certainly proud. He was the king of Thebes. But his crown fell from him. His pride fell from him. There isn't any question but that this is the way the writer, Sophocles, felt. Shortly before the end, just let me hold you for another few seconds here. Creon, the sin of the erring soul drives hard unto death. Behold the slayer, the slain, the father, the son. He's referring to himself. He's the father. Look at my son, Haman. Oh, the curse of my stubborn will. Son, newly cut off in the newness of youth, dead for my fault, not yours. And the chorus says, alas, too late you have seen the truth. Creon, I learn in sorrow. Upon my head God has delivered this heavy punishment, has struck me down in the ways of wickedness, and trod my gladness underfoot. Such is the bitter affliction of mortal man. He acknowledges his own ways of wickedness, and that what has happened to him is a just punishment. Well, we will continue and conclude with Sophocles on Friday. Thank you.